"Aunt to the Queen," says Mary. "There is but one Queen, and that is my mother."
"Lady Mary," Norfolk says, and the words make her burst into tears and run to her room and lock herself in. Suffolk goes up the country to Buckden to convince Catherine to move to another house. She has heard that they mean to send her somewhere even damper than Buckden, and she says the damp will kill her. So she, too, shuts herself up, rattling the bolts into place and shouting at Suffolk in three languages to go away. She will go nowhere, she says, unless he is prepared to break down the door and bind her with ropes and carry her, which Charles thinks is a little extreme. Brandon sounds so sorry for himself when he writes back to London for instructions. A man with a bride of 14 awaiting his attentions to spend the holiday like this. When his letter is read out to the council, he, Cromwell, bursts out laughing. The sheer joy of it carries him into the new year. There is a young woman walking the roads of the kingdom, saying she is the Princess Mary, and that her father has turned her out to beg. She has been seen as far north as York, and as far east as Lincoln, and simple people in these shires are lodging and feeding her, and giving her money to see her on her way. He has people keeping an eye out for her, but they haven't caught her yet. He doesn't know what he would do with her if he did catch her. It is punishment enough to take on the burden of a prophecy, and to be out unprotected on the winter roads. He pictures her, a dun-coloured dwindling figure, tramping away towards the horizon over the flat, muddy fields. Chapter 3. A Painter's Eye, 1534. When Hans brings the finished portrait to Austin Friars, he feels shy of it. He remembers when Walter would say, "Look me in the face, boy, when you tell me a lie." He looks at the picture's lower edge and allows his gaze to creep upwards. A quill, scissors, papers, his seal in a little bag, and a heavy volume bound in blackish green, the leather tooled in gold, the pages gilt-edged. Hans had asked to see his Bible, rejected it as too plain, too thumbed. He had scoured the house and found the finest volume he owned on the desk of Thomas Avery. It is the monk Pacioli's work, the book on how to keep your books, sent to him by his kind friends in Venice. He sees his painted hand, resting on the desk before him, holding a paper in a loose fist. It is uncanny, as if he had been pulled apart, to look at himself in sections, digit by digit. Hans has made his skin smooth as the skin of a courtesan, but the motion he has captured, that folding of the fingers, is as sure as that of a slaughterman's when he picks up the killing knife. He is wearing the cardinal's turquoise. He had a turquoise ring of his own one time, which Liz gave to him when Gregory was born. It was a ring in the shape of a heart. He raises his eyes to his own face. It does not much improve on the Easter egg which Joe painted. Hans had penned him in a little space, pushing a heavy table to fasten him in. He had time to think, while Hans drew him, and his thoughts took him far off to another country. You cannot trace those thoughts behind his eyes. He had asked to be painted in his garden. Hans said, "The very notion makes me sweat. Can we keep it simple?" "Yes." He wears his winter clothes. Inside them, he seems made of a more impermeable substance than most men, more compacted. He could well be wearing armour. He foresees the day when he might have to. There are men in this realm and abroad, not only in Yorkshire now, who would stab him as soon as look at him. I doubt, he thinks, they can hack through to the heart. The king had said, "What are you made of?" He smiles. There is no trace of a smile on the face of his painted self. "Right." He sweeps into the next room. "You can come and see it." They crowd in, jostling. There is a short, appraising silence. It lengthens. Alice says,
"He has made you look rather stout, Uncle. More than he need."
Richard says,
"As Leonardo has demonstrated to us, a curved surface better deflects the impact of cannonballs."
"I don't think you look like that," Helen Barr says. "I see that your features are true enough, but that is not the expression on your face."
Rafe says,
"No, Helen, he saves it for men."
Thomas Avery says,
"The Emperor's man is here. Can he come in and have a look?"
"He is welcome, as always." Chapuis prances in.
He positions himself before the painting. He skips forward. He leaps back. He is wearing marten furs over silks. "Dear God," Joanne says behind her hand, "he looks like a dancing monkey."
"Oh, no, I fear not,"
Estache says.
"Oh, no, 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 no. Your Protestant painter has missed the mark this time. For one never thinks of you alone, Cromwell, but in company, studying the faces of other people as if you yourself mean to paint them. You make other men think not what does he look like, but what do I look like?"
He whisks away, then swings around, as if to catch the likeness in the act of moving.
"Still, looking at that, one would be loath to cross you. To that extent, I think Hans has achieved his aim."
When Gregory comes home from Canterbury, he takes him in alone to see the painting, still in his riding coat, muddy from the road. He wants to hear his son's opinion before the rest of the household get to him. He says, "Your lady mother always said she didn't pick me for my looks. I was surprised when the picture came to find I was vain. I thought of myself as I was when I left Italy 20 years ago, before you were born." Gregory stands at his shoulder. His eyes rest on the portrait. He doesn't speak. He is conscious that his son is taller than he is. Not that it takes much. He steps sideways, though only in his mind, to see his boy with a painter's eye. A boy with fine white skin and hazel eyes. A slender angel of the second rank in a fresco, dappled with damp, in some hill town far from here. He thinks of him as a page in a forest riding across vellum, dark curls crisp under a narrow band of gold. Whereas the young men about him every day, the young men of Austin Friars, are muscled like fighting dogs, hair cropped to stubble, eyes sharp as sword points. He thinks Gregory is all he should be. "He is everything I have a right to hope for. His openness, his gentleness, the reserve and consideration with which he holds back his thoughts till he has framed them. He feels such tenderness for him he thinks he might cry." He turns to the painting. "I fear Mark was right."
"Who is Mark?"
"A silly little boy who runs after George Boleyn. I once heard him say I looked like a murderer," Gregory says.
"Did you not know?"
Part 6, Chapter 1, Supremacy, 1534. In the convivial days between Christmas and New Year, while the court is feasting and Charles Brandon is in the fens shouting at a door, he is rereading Marsilio of Padua. In the year 1324, Marsilio put to us 42 propositions. When the Feast of the Epiphany has passed, he ambles along to put a few of them to Henry. Some of these propositions the king knows. Some are strange to him. Some are congenial in his present situation. Some have been denounced to him as heresy. It's a morning of brilliant, bone-chilling cold. The wind off the river like a knife in the face. We are breezing in to push our luck. Marsilio tells us that when Christ came into this world, he came not as a ruler or a judge, but as a subject. Subject to the state as he found it. He did not seek to rule, nor pass on to his disciples a mission to rule. He did not give power to one of his followers more than another. If you think he did, read again those verses about Peter. Christ did not make popes. He did not give his followers the power to make laws or levy taxes, both of which churchmen have claimed as their right. Henry says, I never remember the cardinal spoke of this. Would you, if you were a cardinal? Since Christ did not induce his followers into earthly power, how can it be maintained that the princes of today derive their power from the Pope? In fact, all priests are subjects, as Christ left them. It is for the prince to govern the bodies of his citizens, to say who is married and who can marry, who is a bastard and who legitimate. Where does the prince get this power, and his power to enforce the law? He gets it through a legislative body, which acts on behalf of the citizens. It is from the will of the people, expressed in Parliament, that a king derives his kingship. When he says this, Henry seems to be straining his ears, as if he might catch the sound of the people coming down the road to turn him out of his palace. He reassures him on the point. Marsilio gives no legitimacy to rebels. Citizens may indeed band together to overthrow a despot, but he, Henry, is not a despot. He is a monarch who rules within the law. Henry likes the people to cheer him as he rides through London, but the wise prince is not always the most popular prince. He knows this. He has other propositions to put to him. Christ did not bestow on his followers grants of land or monopolies, offices, promotions. All these things are the business of the secular power. A man who has taken vows of poverty, how can he have property rights? How can monks be landlords? The king says, Cromwell, with your facility for large numbers, he stares into the distance. His fingers pick at the silver lacing of his cuff. The legislative body, he says, should provide for the maintenance of priests and bishops. After that, it should be able to use the church as well for the public good. But how to free it, Henry says. I suppose shrines can be broken. Jem studied himself. He thinks of the kind of wealth you can weigh. If there were any who dared. It is a characteristic of Henry to run before you to where you were not quite going. He had meant to gentle him towards an intricate legal process of dispossession, repossession, the assertion of ancient sovereign rights, the taking back of what was always yours. He will remember that it was Henry who first suggested picking up a chisel and gouging the sapphire eyes out of saints. But he is willing to follow the king's thought. Christ taught us how to remember him. He left us bread and wine, body and blood. What more do we need? I cannot see where he asked for shrines to be set up, or instituted a trade in body parts, in hair and nails, or asked us to make plaster images and worship them. Would you be able to estimate, Henry says, even... No, I suppose you wouldn't. He gets to his feet. Well, the sun shines, so... Better make hay. He sweeps the day's papers together. I can finish up. Henry goes off to get into his double-padded riding coat. He thinks, we don't want our king to be the poor man of Europe. Spain and Portugal have treasure flowing in every year from the Americas. Where is our treasure? Look around you. His guess is, the clergy own a third of England. One day soon, Henry will ask him how the crown can own it instead. It's like dealing with a child. One day you bring in a box, and the child asks, what is in there? Then it goes to sleep and forgets, but next day it asks again. It doesn't rest until the box is open and the treats given out. Parliament is about to reconvene. He says to the king, no parliament in history has worked as hard as I mean to work this one. Henry says, do what you have to do, I will back you. It's like hearing words you've waited all your life to hear. It's like hearing a perfect line of poetry in a language you knew before you were born. He goes home happy, but the cardinal is waiting for him in a corner. He is plump as a cushion in his scarlet robes, and his face wears a martial and mutinous expression. Wolsey says, you know he will take the credit for your good ideas, and you the blame for his bad ones? When fortune turns against you, you will feel her lash, you always, he never. He says, my dear Wolsey, for now that cardinals have finished in this realm, he addresses him as a colleague, not a master. My dear Wolsey, not entirely so. He didn't blame Charles Brandon for splintering a lance inside his helmet. He blamed himself for not putting his visor down. The Cardinal says, "Do you think this is a tilting ground? Do you think there are rules, protocols, judges to see fair play? One day, when you are still adjusting your harness, you will look up and see him thundering at you downhill." The Cardinal vanishes with a chortle. Even before the Commons convenes, his opponents meet to work out their tactics. Their meetings are not secret. Servants go in and out, and his method with the poll conclaves bears repeating. There are young men in the Cromwell household not too proud to put on an apron and bring in a platter of halibut or a joint of beef. The gentlemen of England apply for places in his household now, for their sons and nephews and wards, thinking they will learn statecraft with him, how to write a secretary's hand, and deal with translation from abroad, and what books one ought to read to be a courtier. He takes it seriously, the trust placed in him. He takes gently from the hands of these noisy young persons their daggers, their pens, and he talks to them, finding out behind the passion and pride of young men of 15 or 20 what they are really worth, what they value, and would value under duress. You learn nothing about men by snubbing them and crushing their pride. You must ask them what it is they can do in this world, that they alone can do. The boys are astonished by the question. Their souls pour out. Perhaps no one has talked to them before, certainly not their fathers. You introduce these boys, violent or unscholarly as they are, to humble occupations. They learn the Psalms. They learn the use of a filleting blade and a paring knife. Only then, for self-defence, and in no formal lesson, they learn the estoc. The killing jerk under the ribs, a simple twist of the wrist that makes you sure. Christophe offers himself as instructor. "These messieurs," he says, "be sure they are dainty. They are cutting off the head of the stag or the tail of the rat, I know not what, to send home to their dear papa. Only you and me, master, and Richard Cromwell. We know how to stop some little fucker in his tracks, so that's the end of him, and he doesn't even squeak." Before spring comes, some of the poor men who stand at his gate find their way inside it. The eyes and ears of the unlettered are as sharp as those of the gentry, and you need not be a scholar to have a good wit. Horseboys and kennelmen overhear the confidences of earls. A boy with kindling and bellows hears the sleepy secrets of early morning when he goes in to light a fire. On a day of strong sunlight, sudden and deceptive warmth, Call Me Risley strides into Austin Friars. He barks, "Give you good morning, sir," throws off his jacket, sits down to his desk, and scrapes forward his stool. He picks up his quill and looks at the tip of it. "Right. What do you have for me?" His eyes are glittering and the tips of his ears are pink. "I think Gardner must be back," he says. "How did you know?" Call Me throws down his pen. He jumps up, he strides about. "Why is he like he is? All this wrangling and jangling, throwing out questions when he doesn't care about the answers. You liked it well enough when you were at Cambridge." "Oh, then," Risley says, with contempt for his young self. "It's supposed to train our minds, I don't know." "My son claims it wore him out, the practice of scholarly disputation. He calls it the practice of futile argument. Perhaps Gregory's not completely stupid." "I would be glad to think not." Call Me blushes a deep red. "I mean no offence, sir. You know Gregory's not like us. As the world goes, he's too good. But you don't have to be like Gardner either." "When the Cardinal's advisers met, we would propose plans. There would perhaps be some dispute, but we would talk it through. Then we would refine our plans and implement them. The King's Council doesn't work like that. How could it? Norfolk, Charles Brandon. They'll fight you because of who you are. Even if they agree with you, they'll fight you. Even if they know you're right." "I suppose Gardiner has been threatening you." "With ruin." He folds one fist into the other. "I don't regard it." "But you should. Winchester is a powerful man, and if he says he will ruin you, that is what he means to do." "He calls me disloyal. He says while I was abroad, I should have minded his interest instead of yours. My understanding is, you serve Master Secretary, whoever is acting in that capacity. If I... He hesitates. If... Risley, I make you this offer. If I am confirmed in the post, I will put you in charge at the Signet. I will be chief clerk. He sees Cormie adding up the fees. So now, go to Gardiner, apologize, and get him to make you a better offer. Hedge your bets. His face alarmed, Cormie hovers. Run, boy! He scoops up his jacket and thrusts it at him. He's still secretary. He can have his seals back. Only tell him he has to come here and collect them in person. Cormie laughs. He rubs his forehead, dazed, as if he's been in a fight. He throws on his coat. We're hopeless, aren't we? Inveterate scrappers. Wolves snapping over a carcass. Lions fighting over Christians. The king calls him in, with Gardiner, to look through the bill he proposes to put into Parliament to secure the succession of Anne's children. The Queen is with them. Many private gentlemen see less of their wives, he thinks, than the King does. He rides, Anne rides. He hunts, Anne hunts. She takes his friends and makes them into hers. She has a habit of reading over Henry's shoulder. She does it now, her exploring hands sliding across his silky bulk, through the layers of his clothing, so that a tiny fingernail hooks itself beneath the embroidered collar of his shirt. And she raises the fabric just a breath, just a fraction, from pale royal skin. Henry's vast hand reaches to caress hers, an absent, dreamy motion, as if they were alone. The draft refers, time and again, and correctly, it would seem, to your most dear and entirely beloved wife, Queen Anne. The Bishop of Winchester is gawping. As a man, he cannot unglue himself from the spectacle, yet as a bishop, it makes him clear his throat. Anne takes no notice. She carries on doing what she's doing and reading out the bill, until she looks up, shocked. It mentions my death. If it should happen, your said dear and entirely beloved wife, Queen Anne, to decease... I can't exclude the event, he says. Parliament can do anything, madam, except what is against nature. She flushes. I shall not die of the child. I am strong. He doesn't remember that Liz lost her wits when she was carrying a child. If anything, she was ever more sober and frugal, and spent time making store-cupboard inventories. Anne, the Queen, takes the draft out of Henry's hand. She shakes it in a passion. She's angry with the paper, jealous of the ink. She says... This bill provides that if I die, say I die now, say I die of a fever and I die undelivered, then he can put another queen in my place. Sweetheart, the king says, I cannot imagine another in your place. It is only notional. He must make provision for it. Madam, Gardiner says, if I may defend Cromwell, he envisages only the customary situation. You would not condemn His Majesty to a life as perpetual widower. And we know not the hour, do we? Anne takes no notice. It's as if Winchester had not spoken. And if she has a son, it says, that son will inherit. It says, heirs male lawfully begotten. Then what happens to my daughter and her claim? Well, Henry says, she is still a princess of England. If you look further down the paper, it says that... He closes his eyes. God give me strength. Gardiner springs to supply some. If the king never had a son, not in lawful matrimony with any woman, then your daughter would be queen. That is what Cromwell proposes. But why must it be written like this? And where does it say that Spanish Mary is a bastard? Lady Mary is out of the line of succession, he says. So the inference is clear. We don't need to say more. You must forgive any coldness of expression. We try to write laws sparingly, and so that they are not personal. By God, Gardiner says with relish, if this isn't personal, what is? The king seems to have invited Stephen to this conference in order to snub him. Tomorrow, of course, it could go the other way, He could arrive to see Henry arm in arm with Winchester and strolling among the snowdrops. He says, "We mean to seal this act with an oath. His Majesty's subjects to swear to uphold the succession to the throne as laid out in this paper and ratified by Parliament." "An oath," Gardiner says. "What sort of legislation needs to be confirmed by an oath?" "You will always find those who will say a Parliament is misled or bought, or in some way incapable of representing the Commonwealth. Again, you will find those who will deny Parliament's competence to legislate in certain matters, saying they must be left to some other jurisdiction. To Rome, in effect. But I think that is a mistake. Rome has no legitimate voice in England. In my bill, I mean to state a position. It is a modest one. I draft it. It may please Parliament to pass it. It may please the King to sign it. I shall then ask the country to endorse it." "So what will you do?" Stephen says, jeering. "Have your boys from Austin Friars up and down the land, swearing every man Jack you dig out of an alehouse? Every man Jack and every Jill?" "Why should I not swear them? Do you think because they are not bishops they are brutes? One Christian's oath is as good as another's. Look at any part of this kingdom, my Lord Bishop, and you will find dereliction, destitution. There are men and women on the roads. The sheep farmers are grown so great that the little man is knocked off his acres and the ploughboy is out of house and home. In a generation these people can learn to read. The ploughman can take up a book. Believe me, Gardiner, England can be otherwise." "I have made you angry," Gardiner observes. "Provoked. You mistake the question. I asked you not if their word is good, but how many of them you propose to swear. But, of course, in the Commons you have brought in a bill against sheep." "Against the runners of sheep," he says, smiling. The King says, "Gardiner, it is to help the common people. No grazier to run more than 2,000 animals." The Bishop cuts his King off as if he were a child. 2,000, yes. So while your commissioners are rampaging through the shires counting sheep, perhaps they can swear the shepherds at the same time, eh? And these ploughboys of yours, in their preliterate condition, and any jabs they find in a ditch." He has to laugh. The Bishop is so vehement. "My lord, I will swear whoever is necessary to make the succession safe and unite the country behind us. The King has his officers, his justices of the peace, and the lords of the council will be put on their honour to make this work, or I will know why." Henry says, "The bishops will take the oath. I hope they will be conformable."
"We want some new bishops," Anne says.
She names her friend Hugh Latimer, his friend Roland Lee. It seems, after all, she does have a list, which she carries in her head. Liz made preserves. Anne makes pastas. "Latimer?" Stephen shakes his head. But he cannot accuse the Queen to her face of loving heretics. "Roland Lee, to my certain knowledge, has never stood in a pulpit in his life. Some men come into the religious life only for ambition, and have barely the grace to disguise it," he says. "I make the best of my road," Stephen says. "I was set upon it. By God, Cromwell, I walk it." He looks up at Anne. Her eyes sparkle with glee. Not a word is lost on her. Henry says, "My Lord Winchester, you have been out of the country a great while on your embassy. I hope your Majesty thinks it has been to his profit." "Indeed, but you have not been able to avoid neglecting your diocese."
"As a pastor, you should mind your flock," Anne says. "Count them, perhaps."
He bows. "My flock is safe in fold." Short of kicking the bishop downstairs himself, or having him hauled out by the guards, the King can't do much more. "All the same, feel free to attend to it," Henry murmurs. There is a feral stink that rises from the hide of a dog about to fight. It rises now into the room, and he sees Anne turn aside, fastidious, and Stephen put his hand to his chest, as if to ruffle up his fur, to warn of his size before he bares his teeth. "I shall be back with your Majesty within a week," he says. His dulcet sentiment comes out as a snarl from the depth of his guts. Henry bursts into laughter. "Meanwhile, we like Cromwell. Cromwell treats us very well.
Once Winchester has gone, Anne hangs over the king again. Her eyes flick sideways, as if she were drawing him into conspiracy.